We are on this chapter 5, The Cosmic Illusion, Mind, Dream, and Hallucination. 431, at a certain point of this constant unrest and travail. So at this point in the chapter, Sri Aurobindo is talking about the problem of knowledge, which is actually this entire part of the Life Divine is about. And essentially, he is posing the fundamental doubt with which we come into this world. And this doubt has two components. One component is a mental component. Anything that we can affirm, we can also deny. We can come up with interpretations of this world, because as mental beings, we are prefigured into trying to understand the reality into which we are thrown, as it were. We come into this world without any sense of the nature of the world, and yet we have within us the kind of apparatus that does not rest content without trying to understand what this world is about. And so this sense of trying to make sense of the world is something that is constantly baffled by its doubt, its uncertainties. That is the mental component, as he points out. And at this point of the chapter, he is trying to show the other ground of our uncertainty, and that is the vital component. The idea of a life mind and a life consciousness, which is constantly trying to outdo the fixities of the conditions in which we find ourselves. And even here we find that there isn't any, enduring good that we can establish through our efforts. There is a constant sense of struggle. And as he points out, all the psychological tools that we have developed so far have not been successful in really changing our world. So we come over here and we find this particular passage where he has moved from that idea of a life mind or vital mentality to talk about now the physical mind losing its conviction of objective certitude. So unless there are any comments or questions at this point, we can start reading. Does anybody want to say anything, comment on what we've read so far or question anything? I was noticing that the paragraph just concluding, he transitions within that paragraph itself from the vital mind to the mind proper. So he actually establishes the three layers of our consciousness, the physical with the physical mind, the vital with the vital mind, and the mind proper. And towards the end of that paragraph, he's speaking about that transition. He says, to add to this cause of unrest and incertitude, there comes in a thinking mind that inquires into everything, questions everything, builds up affirmations and unbuilds them, erects systems of certitude, but finally accepts none of them as certain, so etc., and talks about that as the history of human thought and human endeavor, a constant breaking of bounds, only to move always in the same spirals, enlarged perhaps, but following the same or constantly similar curves of direction. So we find that there is a certain kind of ignorance, a fundamental and radical ignorance to all our instruments of knowing. And these instruments of knowing are different in their modality of consciousness, yet they are marked by their own sense of ignorance, as it were. This is, as he has pointed out over here. And we can start this paragraph at a certain point of this constant unrest and travail.
At a certain point of this constant unrest and travail, even the physical mind loses its conviction of objective certitude and enters into an agnosticism which questions all its own standards of life and knowledge, doubts whether all this is real, or else whether all, even if real, is not futile. The vital mind, baffled by life and frustrated, or else dissatisfied with all its satisfactions, overtaken by a deep disgust and disappointment, finds that all is vanity and vexation of spirit, and is ready to reject life and existence as an unreality, all that it hunted after as an illusion, Maya. The thinking mind, unbuilding all its affirmations, discovers that all are mere mental constructions, and there is no reality in them, or else that the only reality is something beyond this existence, something that has not been made or constructed, something absolute and eternal. All that is relative, all that is of time, is a dream, a hallucination of the mind, or a vast delirium, an immense cosmic illusion, a delusive figure of apparent existence. The principle of negation prevails over the principle of affirmation and becomes universal and absolute. Thence arise the great word-negating religions and philosophies. Thence, too, a recoil of the life motive from itself and a seeking after a life elsewhere, flawless and eternal, or a will to annul life itself in an immobile reality or an original non-existence. In India, the philosophy of world negation has been given formulations of supreme power and value by two of the greatest of her thinkers, Buddha and Shankara. There have been, intermediate or later in time, other philosophies of considerable importance, some of them widely accepted, formulated with much acumen of thought by men of genius and spiritual insight, which disputed with more or less force and success the conclusions of these two great metaphysical systems. But none have been put forward with an equal force of presentation or drive of personality or had a similar massive effect. The spirit of these two remarkable spiritual philosophies, for Shankara and the historical process of India's philosophical mind, takes up, completes, and replaces Buddha, has weighed with a tremendous power on her thought, religion, and general mentality. Everywhere broods its mighty shadow. Everywhere is the impress of the three great formulas, the chain of karma, escape from the wheel of rebirth, Maya. It is necessary, therefore, to look afresh at the idea or truth behind the negation of cosmic existence, and to consider, however briefly, what is the value of its main formulations or suggestions, on what reality they stand, how far they are imperative to the reason or to experience. For the present, it will be enough to throw a regard on the principal ideas which are grouped around the conception of the great cosmic illusion Maya, and to set against them those that are proper to our own line of thought and vision. For both proceed from the conception of the one reality. But one line leads to a universal illusionism, the other to a universal realism. An unreal or real-unreal universe reposing on a transcendent reality, or a real universe reposing on a reality at once universal and transcendent or absolute.
So he speaks here of the disillusionment. It's like a historical disillusionment which arrives over time through the accumulation of the sense of ignorance that these three modalities of consciousness experience. And so as he says, that there is a kind of illusionism that creeps both into the physical mind and the vital. The vital, what enters is a sense of frustration, which seems to give it a kind of tendency to nihilism, to want to negate any activity. And to the mind, there arrives this a sense of relativism, which makes it feel that there is ultimately no truth, and that whatever it is experiencing must be unreal, and must be arriving from some source that does not have any relationship with our experience. And so it is this third, because ultimately it is the mind which makes sense, the mind which is the predominant faculty of knowledge, that tries to give an explanation. And the explanation for this kind of nihilism comes to it from the notion of a reality or an unreality as the foundation of things, and of a kind of illusion that we experience that must be kept in place by some power. And so what could be this power? And here Sri Aurobindo points to the two major what are called Mayavadin philosophies of India, which come to us from Buddha and from Shankara. We may also look at the West and say that from a certain kind of confidence in the power of the mind, which comes to it relatively late and which becomes really the foundation of the world in which we live today, a kind of systematic effort at finding the laws of the universe and utilizing them to create a better world. From this, there arises a kind of recoil, because though it achieves what one might consider a certain amount, a considerable amount of amelioration of the human condition at the level of the physical and even of the vital experience, there is still a fundamental lack of knowledge and of ability that comes with it. And we find that the critique of this kind of experience of the world arrives within the Enlightenment itself, with thinkers like Kant, who proposes that we can never really know reality as it is. But his philosophy is nevertheless not a illusionism, nor is it a pessimism, because he feels that reason nevertheless can help us to build from the world that we see around us a kind of safe haven, a world which has a certain degree of a relative perfection. So this is where Kantianism starts opening the gates of critical thought, which ultimately lead to our present times, and the sense of uncertainty becomes radicalized, and we have what we know today as absurdism. Absurdism as a philosophy ultimately posits itself on a similar nihilism, that there is really no basis of meaning to the world, that we are thrown into this absurd world. In the case of India, as he's pointing out, this, what we might call idealist, agnosticism of a mental idealist kind, is replaced by a spiritual idealist nihilism. And that is what we find with the Buddha, who is saying that our experience is really something which is kept in place by some kind of mechanism. It's almost like a kind of a whirlwind or a tornado which has nothing substantial to its basis, but is just picking up dust and creating a sense of reality, which, if broken, just completely disappears. So this mechanism by which it is kept in place is founded on these three pillars, as Sri Aurobindo points out over here, the three pillars of karma, the wheel of rebirth, and of Maya. Now, this kind of philosophy, the philosophy of Buddha, as it is stated in this form, still leaves major questions unanswered. Because even if there is to be thought a certain kind of movement or a certain kind of mechanism, where did that mechanism arise from? And what is its ground? Though he refuses to give a name to that ground, the question can still be asked. And this is exactly why Sri Aurobindo points out that Shankara completes the thought of Buddha. He gives it a name and he connects it to the Vedantic tradition. So in a way, he does two things. On the one hand, he gives a greater philosophical cogency to Buddha's illusionism. And on the other hand, he actually interprets the Upanishads and hence foregrounds the other traditions of India, which today we call the Hindu traditions, and make them into the foundation of the same kind of illusionism. So this is what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out over here. In the case of Shankara, there is an ultimate ground, which is the ground of identity. It is a Brahman, but the experience that we have is somehow an illusion on the surface of Brahman, or something that is kept in place by some mysterious power within Brahman. For Sri Aurobindo asks the question, if Brahman is the only thing there is, and if it is self-conscious, then how could there be anything within it of which it is not conscious? This is the query that he makes. Of course, Shankara evades that question by saying that this is an illegitimate question, that it does not really occur as far as Brahman is concerned. But nevertheless, this kind of illusionism, Sri Aurobindo is going to approach not by asking that question in this particular case, but by looking at the logic with which both these schools try to affirm the illusoriness of our experience. And that is through some kind of insubstantial reality. In other words, or insubstantial unreality. In other words, that our experience is like a dream or a hallucination. So these are the two terms which this particular chapter contains in its title itself. And he fields these terms here in this paragraph when he raises these as metaphors used by these Mayavadin schools to give meaning to our experience. He says, all that is relative, all that is of time is a dream, a hallucination of the mind, or a vast delirium, an immense cosmic illusion. So there is that jump from dream, hallucination, delirium, which are stages of unreality in experience, to this philosophical principle of illusion, a delusive figure of apparent existence. So this is exactly what he's going to address to ask the question of whether indeed our experience is one of dream or hallucination. And even if that is the case, what it really is the meaning of dream or hallucination. At the end of the paragraph, he posits the contrast between these Mayavadin schools and his own view, which he has introduced earlier, and he posits it in a kind of a sharp manner as a distinction between either a conception of one reality leading to a universal illusionism, or the same reality leading to a universal realism. And then he qualifies it by saying an unreal or real unreal. In other words, it's real, but it's experienced in an unreal fashion. Universe reposing on a transcendent reality, or a real universe reposing on a reality at once universal and transcendent or absolute. In other words, the universe or the universal, the description of the reality to itself is also a reality and has no illusory power in it.
In itself and by itself, the vital being's aversion, the life mind's recoil from life, cannot be taken as valid or conclusive. Its strongest motive is a sense of disappointment and an acceptance of frustration, which has no greater claim to conclusiveness than the idealist's opposite motive of invariable hope and his faith and will to realize. Nevertheless, there is a certain validity in the mental support of this sense of frustration, in the perception at which the thinking mind arrives that there is an illusion behind all human effort and terrestrial endeavor, the illusion of his political and social gospels, the illusion of his ethical efforts at perfection, the illusion of philanthropy and service, the illusion of works, the illusion of fame, power, success, the illusion of all achievement. Human social and political endeavor turns always in a circle and leads nowhere. Man's life and nature remain always the same, always imperfect, and neither laws nor institutions nor education nor philosophy nor morality nor religious teachings have succeeded in producing the perfect man, still less a perfect humanity. Straighten the tail of the dog as you will, it has been said, it always resumes its natural curve of crookedness. Altruism, philanthropy, and service, Christian love or Buddhist compassion, have not made the world a whit happier. They only give infinitesimal bits of momentary relief here and there, throw drops on the fire of the world's suffering. All aims are in the end transitory and futile, all achievements unsatisfying or evanescent. All works are so much labor of effort and success and failure, which consummate nothing definite or definitive. Whatever changes are made in human life are of the form only, and these forms pursue each other in a futile circle, for the essence of life, its general character, remains the same forever. This view of things may be exaggerated, but it has an undeniable force. It is supported by the experience of man's centuries, and it carries in itself a significance which at one time or another comes upon the mind with an overwhelming air of self-evidence. Not only so, but if it is true that the fundamental laws and values of terrestrial existence are fixed, or that it must always turn in repeated cycles, and this has been for long a very prevalent notion, then this view of things in the end is hardly escapable. For imperfection, ignorance, frustration, and suffering are a dominant factor of the existing world order. The elements contrary to them, knowledge, happiness, success, perfection, are constantly found to be deceptive or inconclusive. The two opposites are so inextricably mixed that if this state of things is not a motion towards a greater fulfillment, if this is the permanent character of the world order, then it is hard to avoid the conclusion that all here is either the creation of an inconscient energy, which would account for the incapacity of an apparent consciousness to arrive at anything, or intentionally a world of ordeal and failure, the issue being not here but elsewhere, or even a vast and aimless cosmic illusion.
So here Sri Aurobindo takes up the vital dissatisfaction first, the frustration that comes over the vital in its struggle, which seems to be endless and which doesn't arrive at any permanent condition of good in our personal or social existence. There is a little amelioration, but there is an enormous amount of suffering, and the fundamental truth of suffering is not ameliorated in any way. And so Sri Aurobindo first says that the vital's response to its own experience need not give us a permanent understanding of reality, because the vital may just be recoiling. But the vital in human beings works by taking the support of the mind. And this is the reason why he says that the thinking mind, which is called by the vital to justify its experience, has a certain kind of truth behind it. It manages to justify the vital dissatisfaction, because there is a certain weight to this experience of frustration. Anybody who draws upon the lessons of history can see how tremendously weighty this is, how there has been very little change, if we look at the human condition, to the fundamental problem of suffering. And so this is really one of the reasons why thinkers like the Buddha could come up with this argument for escape from this reality. He could draw on it by making an appeal to this kind of vital experience. Now, on the other hand, and Sri Aurobindo's analysis of all the futilities of human existence is really so penetrating, as he gives you the list of the various things that we do to make our life worthwhile. But when we actually, poke a little needle into the balloons of our own ego, we find that it deflates very quickly, and we see that all that sense of elation was really an illusion. Then what he comes to is ultimately this idea that there must be, the mind's justification leads it to this notion of three kinds of possibilities for this type of constant, unchanging condition of suffering. Of course, we can go back to the Veda and see that, and the Upanishad, and see that there is posited this constant battle between the gods and the demons. The world is a relative field of battle in which neither the gods or the demons is ultimately given a greater position. Each one challenges the other. And this condition is classed in the Upanishads as avidya. And ultimately, avidya in its fundamental meaning means ignorance. It's translated as ignorance. So what is the nature of that cosmic ignorance, which makes this possible? Is it something within us? Is it an original sin? Or is it some kind of a reality that belongs to some other sphere from which we have derived? So the three possibilities that he comes up with are interesting because they are related to three civilizational attitudes. The first one is that it is really an inconscient energy that has really no meaning to it, has no respect or sympathy for all our sense of trying to make meaning of it. In other words, it is an inconscient energy, and this is the viewpoint of science, which holds that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the processes of matter and energy. So consciousness has arisen. It is in a hapless position of trying to make sense of this world, but there is no sense to be made because ultimately it is an amoral, inconscient energy that is just working out its processes, and we are stuck in its groove forever. The second kind of stand he takes is a stand that we find in the ancient Greeks, which is that of a tragic universe, a very strong sense of tragedy prevails. For example, in the myth of Sisyphus, who is forced by powers that are beyond his own agency to push a huge boulder up a mountain and fated to see it fall and raise it again. So this is image of a intentional world of ordeal and failure, the issue being not here but elsewhere. And the third one is this spiritual illusionism. In other words, this has no meaning, but it's not due to a material meaninglessness. It's due to the indifference of Brahman. Brahman is immune to the experiences that we are going through because these experiences do not really belong to it. Somewhere it is transcendent, and within its transcendence, something is creating this kind of disturbed dream which it does not partake in. So these are the three views that make sense to the mind which tries to give account to the vital for its dissatisfaction. So the vital really has only the experience of personal time. For the vital, the experience of time belongs to this life, but still it has a lot of intensity and it draws on the mind. And when the mind tries to justify the vital, and as you very well pointed out, it brings its own more expansive sense of time and gives it a certain kind of philosophical basis so that it seems to justify it based on another ground of criterion or experience than what the vital itself could have come up with. That's why he starts by saying that the vital, if it was left to itself and its own experience, would not have been so justified, because it would have been just a kind of temporary reaction that gave it its own personal or subjective dissatisfaction. But once it brings the mind to its aid, another kind of expansive contact with the universe and with the sense of time allows it to posit a certain philosophical justification for its sense of dissatisfaction, frustration. The vital is something that is very close to the physical also, and the vital is constantly wanting quick solutions, because as he pointed out, the vital is expecting to change things and it's struggling to do that. And so, in a sense, this impatience is also stamped by the physical existence. It feels that it has to achieve it very quickly. Again, as you were pointing out, the sense of time that the vital has is a much more intense sense tied to the life of the body and also the cycles of the body, the various movements by which the body runs. And so its experience of frustration guides its impatience. When the vital has to depend on its own resources and even on the vital mind, it is only tied to this kind of rajasic movement and its own scale, which it cannot transcend that scale. While the mind can move from scale to scale of experience of time. And that's the reason why the mind can actually bring to the aid of the vital a greater philosophical reason, but it does that by suppressing other possibilities. So that we can say that the lessons of history can validate the frustrations of the individual life, but the mind can think otherwise as well. The mind can think of even further possibilities in which there is a certain kind of challenge thrown to the consciousness that is evolving. The power of evolution is not addressed by the vital, which is ultimately moving from one experience to another within an immediate time frame. So I would agree that that is really the basis of this kind of frustration. And even when it draws on the mind, it's really projecting its own experience and getting the mind to selectively look at a certain type of experience over a larger scale of time or history.
Among these alternative conclusions, the second, as it is usually put before us, offers no ground for the philosophic reason, since we have no satisfying indication of the connection between the here and the elsewhere, which are posited against each other, but not explained in the inevitability of their relations. And there is no light cast on the necessity of fundamental significance of the ordeal and failure. It could only be intelligible, except as the mysterious will of an arbitrary creator, if there was a choice by immortal spirits to try the adventure of the ignorance and a necessity for them to learn the nature of a world of ignorance in order that they might reject it. But such a creative motive, necessarily incidental and quite temporary in its incidence, with the earth as its casual field of experience, could hardly by itself account for the immense and enduring phenomenon of this complex universe. It can become an operative part of a satisfactory explanation if this world is the field for the working out of a greater creative motive, if it is a manifestation of a divine truth or a divine possibility, in which, under certain conditions, an initiating ignorance must intervene as a necessary factor, and if the arrangement of this universe contains in it a compulsion of the ignorance to move towards knowledge, of the imperfect manifestation to grow into perfection, of the frustration to serve as steps towards a final victory, of the suffering to prepare an emergence of the divine delight of being. In that case, the sense of disappointment, frustration, illusion, and the vanity of all things would not be valid, for the aspects that seem to justify it would be only the natural circumstances of a difficult evolution. All the stress of struggle and effort, success and failure, joy and suffering, the mixture of ignorance and knowledge, would be the experience needed for the soul, mind, life, and physical part to grow into the full light of a spiritual perfected being. It would reveal itself as the process of an evolutionary manifestation. There would be no need to bring in the fiat of an arbitrary omnipotence or a cosmic illusion, a fantasy of meaningless Maya.
So it's interesting that Sri Aurobindo takes up over here for consideration the second of those three options first. Because we see that the other two are bracketing off the second. If we look at it, the first of those three options is that of a meaningless material energy. And the third of these three options is that of a meaningless absolute indifference. So between these is sandwiched some kind of a life reality, a life experience. And if we are to look at this life experience as having a relationship in some spiritual ground, then the question arises, what is the nature of that relationship? And if we are going to look at the vital and say that, well, because the vital is unsatisfied, dissatisfied, then that relationship must be a relationship with some beyond, which is either cruel or arbitrary, then that is just also just an arbitrary explanation. It doesn't have any kind of cogency to its explanation. This is how we were also saying that when the vital draws the mind to its use for justification, then the mind under the influence of the vital also becomes selective. And that selectiveness is really a distortion, an exaggeration. This is why the mother has said that the mind under the influence of the vital often distorts reality and comes into the clutches of the falsehood. Distortion is the very essence of a falsehood. It suppresses and privileges certain options. On the other hand, he's also pointing to this notion of an arbitrary creator, that if there was the mysterious will of an arbiter, it's like a despot who just is absolute, so decides to work out any kind of reality in which there are some people who suffer, and a reality which is constantly sunk in this kind of suffering. And that sort of truth, as he's saying, that sort of idea is really not also of a kind of absolute significance. Though we find that that kind of an idea is posited by the Indian schools, which in a way hold that the condition of the cosmos is eternal. This, what they call ignorance or avidya, is eternal. But at the same time, they affirm the absolute nature of the divine by saying that to the divine, the suffering is only a play of rasa. In other words, there are various emotions, and the play of those emotions is going on over here, and these are just transformations of ananda, but they are experienced by us as a happiness and suffering. Now, that also is an explanation that gives no meaning or significance to our existence. And ultimately, we see that Sri Aurobindo, in all his work, in the whole life divine, is paying a lot of importance to meaning, to the fact that there is meaning to this existence, that we to our experience. Or what is that meaning? That we are justified in seeking a meaning. And ultimately, the root of that meaning is supermind, Because supermind is the notion of a real idea that gives meaning to everything. So he comes to this other possibility, which is again something he posits and dismisses, of souls that for some reason need to have the experience of an unhappy condition. So there is a world, just like a hell, of this kind of unsatisfactory experience into which these souls are plunged, so that they arrive at a conclusion that this is not worth living, because they mistakenly wanted to experience it, so they had to go through it, and then they come out of it and say that, okay, I know now that this is not worth living in. But then he says that that kind of explanation, again, that kind of meaning, sense of meaning, it leaves the entire complexity of this cosmos totally unexplained. There is too much that is left unexplained. It's very arbitrary, that kind of an explanation. And so he posits, based on the dissatisfaction of the vital, the mind can think of that as an emergent condition, that there is a certain inconscience from which consciousness has arisen, and in its imperfect arising, experiences this kind of state. But this state, however long it has existed, is also part of an evolution that need not remain where it is, and is really bears a certain kind of relation with the ground of its emergence, which is that of its own self-exploration and self-vindication, that it needs to know what it is and experience its own power. So this is the idea of the evolutionary meaning, that the philosophical mind can derive from the experience of the vital as something which is positive and has a true ground in a monistic consciousness, something which is one and is experienced by the many. This kind of explanation also vindicates the evolution of individual souls. See, so that is exactly why we are participating in this evolution. It is not just an evolution, a cosmic evolution in which we are carried and we are subject to its whims or its movements, but we are participating in its transformation, its evolution and transformation.
But there is too a higher mental and spiritual basis for the philosophy of world negation, and here we are on more solid ground, for it can be contended that the world is in its very nature an illusion, and no reasoning from the features and circumstances of an illusion could justify it or raise it into a reality. There is only one reality, the transcendent, the supracosmic. No divine fulfillment, even if our life were to grow into the life of the gods, could nullify or cancel the original unreality, which is its fundamental character. For that fulfillment would be only the bright side of an illusion. Or even, if not absolutely an illusion, it would be a reality of an inferior order and must come to an end by the soul's recognition that the Brahman alone is true, that there is nothing but the transcendent and immutable absolute. If this is the one truth, then all ground is cut away from under our feet. The divine manifestation, the victory of the soul in matter, its mastery over existence, the divine life in nature, would itself be a falsehood, or at least something not altogether real, imposed for a time on the sole true reality. But here, all turns on the mind's conception, on the mental being's experience of reality, and how far that conception is valid, or how far that experience is imperative, even if it is a spiritual experience, how far it is absolutely conclusive, solely imperative.
So as we see here, Sri Aurobindo is then making a case for the mind's own understanding. So we can say that the vital, if it is to justify its own experience, can come up either with a negative or a positive interpretation, or can draw on the mind, and the mind can give it either a negative or a positive interpretation. And he provides these, and he shows us that the positive interpretation is actually closer to a philosophical justification of an absolute monism than the negative interpretations, that there is a one reality, but that one reality is expressing itself through an evolution in which suffering is an intermediary stage in the evolution of the souls, and their participation in expressing the perfection of the spirit. But here he comes to a mental validation which is not based on the vital experience, but directly on the absoluteness of monism itself. That is, that if there is one reality, undifferentiated, self-conscious, that knows itself only in essence, not in existence. In other words, that it is just self-aware, but not any kind of description of itself that it might try to give to itself, can only be incomplete, can never ultimately match up to its self-awareness. So this is the point that he's making, that even if we say that there is a certain single reality, and that reality is being expressed in some way, and we are trying to make that expression into something perfect, and even if we arrive at some kind of good out of that manifestation, as he says, that even if there is a divine manifestation or a victory of the soul in matter, its mastery over existence, still that kind of divine life in nature would itself be a falsehood, or at least something not altogether real, imposed for a time on the sole true reality. In other words, that this would be a figure. It would be only a shadow. And that shadow also could never fully represent the reality, because the reality would be absolute and immune from any kind of adequate representation. Every representation would fall short of it. So this is the absolutist philosophical idealist argument of spiritual idealism that we find ultimately in people like Shankara, that there is a phenomenal existence which is always temporary and transient, and that can express some power that is satisfactory to us maybe, but even in doing that, it will only be a very inadequate excrescence on the truth. And the truth alone is worth striving for. So this is the mental basis, as he's saying, higher mental and spiritual basis for the philosophy of world negation. So if this is the case, then what is the nature of that self-expression? Or he wouldn't, you see, like in Shankara's case, if he is to call it a self-expression, then naturally then one falls into the trap of saying that Brahman is expressing itself falsely. Why would Brahman express itself falsely? So they must then posit a certain kind of implicit dualism where there is something called Maya that is expressing these inadequate kind of illusions, projections within Brahman. So that those are not really the self-expressions of Brahman, but the expressions of Brahman created by some power within it, a power of dream, run amok, as it were, operating on autopilot, just doing whatever it wants, so to say. And if that's the case, then what is the substantiality of this world? It is a illusory thing. There is no substantiality. According to Buddha, there is no substantiality. According to Shankara, there is a substantiality, but this substantiality is of Maya's making, and it isn't a real, it's an illusory substantiality, like a mirage.
The cosmic illusion is sometimes envisaged, though that is not the accepted position, as something that has the character of an unreal subjective experience. It is then, or maybe, a figure of forms and movements that arises in some eternal sleep of things, or in a dream consciousness, and is temporarily imposed on a pure and featureless self-aware existence. It is a dream that takes place in the infinite. In the philosophies of the Mayavadins, for there are several systems alike in their basis, but not altogether and at every point coincident with each other, the analogy of dream is given, but as an analogy only, not as the intrinsic character of the world illusion. It is difficult for the positive physical mind to admit the idea that ourselves, the world and life, the sole thing to which our consciousness bears positive witness, are inexistent, a cheat imposed on us by that consciousness. Certain analogies are brought forward, the analogies especially of dream and hallucination, in order to show that it is possible for the experiences of the consciousness to seem to it real, and yet prove to be without any basis or without a sufficient basis in reality. As a dream is real to the dreamer so long as he sleeps, but waking shows it to be unreal, so our experience of world seems to us positive and real, but when we stand back from the illusion, we shall find that it had no reality. But it may be as well to give the dream analogy its full value, and see whether our sense of world experience has in any way a similar basis. For the idea of the world as a dream, whether it be a dream of the subjective mind, or a dream of the soul, or a dream in the eternal, is often entertained, and it powerfully enforces the illusionist tendency in human feeling and thinking. If it has no validity, we must definitely see that and the reasons for its inapplicability and set it aside well out of the way. If it has some validity, we must see what it is and how far it goes. If the world is an illusion but not a dream illusion, That distinction too must be put on a secure basis.
So now he comes to probe that experience that the Mayavadins are claiming is a dream or is a illusion or is some kind of a false representation that is being projected within the one reality or within Brahman. And so this, as he points out over here, that these, they are not really saying that it is a dream, but they are saying that it is best understood through the analogy of a dream. So Sri Aurobindo is asking the question, what is the truth of that analogy? Where does the analogy fit? Why should we accept that the dream is an adequate analogy for the kind of experience that we go through? And of course, the other one he points out is that of a hallucination or an illusion. A hallucination is a kind of appearance, and this appearance of something which may or may not have any reality, or an illusion may be it may be a delusion. In other words, it may be an appearance of something for something else. And in fact, Shankara makes a good deal of that, where he points out that we mistake a rope for a snake. And when we get really afraid of it and we behave in certain ways about it, but were we to probe its reality, we'd find that it is innocuous and has no hold on us. It is a rope. So these are analogies that are used to explain the illusory nature of our experience of a Brahman. And what keeps that illusion in place? Why is it there? Why do we experience it like that? We experience it like that because there is a certain power, the power of Maya, that is making us experience it like that. So the analysis of that state in the case of Shankara is going to look at what is the experience itself and how can we nullify the reality of that experience. As a result, Sri Aurobindo is now going to look at the nature of that analogy. So he's going to say, if it is analogous to a dream, what is it in a dream that makes that analogy into something which can be used to posit this philosophy? Our sense of the reality of this phenomenal experience is in itself faulty. It's either a delusion or an illusion. That is true. But that does not go further for us to say that reality itself is projecting a delusion or an illusion and there is no meaning to it. Ultimately, that is going to be the entire question. The question is that whatever has been projected has got a certain kind of reality, that it is the self-expression of Brahman, not a kind of a some power which Brahman is unaware of and from which we have to escape ultimately into the absolute, but something which we have to see for its truth and which we have to ultimately bring into the notion of the self-expression of reality. That's why, if you notice, and that's the nature his analysis will take, when we began the chapter, he had that long quote from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which actually also parallels the Mandukya Upanishad, which talks about the different states of being, the avasthas, that there is a state of waking, a state of dream, and a state of what is normally called dreamless sleep. He's going to use the word sleep with a capital S. And that he's basically saying that these are all states of Brahman, that it's not that one is more or less Brahman. Each one of these is nothing but Brahman, but it is Brahman that is kind of held in place by a certain tapas of being. And that tapas of being is what we are caught in. Of course, we have to unravel that to travel along all these states, but we have to affirm all these states and find the meaning in them. Why are they there? Why is Brahman doing this sacrifice in which we are participating? So he's going to question that, and he's going to say that, yeah, you think that because there are certain laws, there is a law of endurance. Things endure over here, and we come back to the same world as it were. It's a predictable world. But when we go back to sleep, we may not go into a predictable world. We may go into a world which is completely different from what we dreamt yesterday. And so there is a certain kind of other reality there, a reality which we can't give as much, you know, sense of reality to as the world in which we enter waking. But he's going to question that as well. He's going to question also the nature of this persistence that we experience as real. Yeah, another part of that quality of experience is the collective nature of that reality, that we not only see the same things, we affirm with others that same word. See, we see the same others and we affirm with those others that same word, so that we can give a certain kind of, you know, collective coherence to that word. No, he's not saying we need to reject it, but he's saying we need to develop other powers of experience. He's basically going to say that there are universal subliminal planes which have a coherence, and we don't experience them because, as the Upanishad says, the senses are fastened outwards, but there are other powers by which we can experience the persistent, you know, the consistent nature of the inner worlds, and that we have to develop those. This is the argument that he's going to, and you see that this is part of Sri Aurobindo's argumentation, where sometimes he takes you beyond normal experience, and he's actually developing it out of his own experience, or out of the experience of others like himself who have voiced themselves maybe in some texts like the Upanishads, etc., but basically who he's saying that if this has been experienced, it cannot be rejected, basically. Just because you don't experience it, you can't reject it. This is how he takes his method. This is phenomenal, or this is relative. That kind of mental attitude has to arise. And maybe mind is not totally incapable, but mind is not used to it. As you know, we can see we are creatures of prakriti, so we have been created in a certain way. But this is the cusp of the evolution where the Purusha has to push the boundary and transform the operations that have actually been put into us. So that's where this whole business about kind of going beyond and unraveling the laws of nature comes in. If we could either just accept the laws of nature and say this is the reality, but that's the reason the mind is full of doubt. It cannot accept that this reality is the only reality there is. And then you can draw on people who have said that no, there are ways by which we can go beyond this reality, and that's when something else other than the mind kicks in and says that yes, there is possibly a truth to this and I can try to do this. It's as Sri Aurobindo himself says when Lele told him that thoughts come to the mind from outside. He said that the first thought he had was this is the most outlandish idea, because he just couldn't imagine that something like this could be true, but immediately he knew, he felt that it's worth trying, that it could possibly be true. Yeah, hold some reality of personal thought, you mean? That I'm thinking these thoughts, yeah. True. Well, he's saying the cosmic mind is thinking. And I'm subject to it. Yeah, I suppose so. But see, the whole thing is dependent on experience. Abstractly, we can or cannot. But once we experience it, with it comes other factors as well. That's the reason why he says that from the time he started perceiving that, he became a independent channel in communication with the cosmic mind. So the idea of the cosmic mind is not something abstract at that point. You immediately know there is a cosmic mind that's thinking. It's abstract only when we are thinking about it. But when we experience it, it comes with other kinds of knowledge. Sure. That's, I think the whole argument he'll make is for the case for the necessity for that. That basically, that there are, and he'll go through the analysis of dream to point to that, in fact. So it's a kind of what they call a jnana yoga, where the analysis of our own experience leads to changes in our understanding. And our own, the exercises that we conduct with regard to experience. So, okay, I think we are at 9:40. I think we've passed our time. And the next session will be on 11th June, I believe. Am I right? 11 June? Yeah, yes. Okay, so I think we'll call off today and we'll gather back on 11 June. Yeah. Yeah, I think he'll be back on 11 June. He only wanted to let us know that this today he can't conduct it because he's traveling. But the next time he'll be conducted. Okay. Thank you. Thanks. See you next time. Bye-bye. Adios.